Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of the Daily Friends Show. It's another wonderful week in South Africa. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, sir?
I'm okay, Nicholas. And yourself?
I'm pretty good, thank you. And joining us from Cape Town with a bit of an internet problem, so there may be a slight delay in his hearing this message, is Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you? Oh, no, it's worse than I thought. Anyway, okay, while we sort that problem out.
My governance in South Africa. Oh, no, it's worse than I thought.
Let me, I've muted you quick, Michael, because your voice is going to come through quite late, but we'll see if it improves just now. Okay, let's first start off with a word from our sponsor. We've got a little bit of admin to get through today. We are once again sponsored this week by Bitvice. We all know that Bitvice says we all know that Bitcoin is the best performing asset of the past decade, and many people are accumulating Bitcoin as a strategy to hedge themselves against fiat currency debasement and government overreach. The guys at Bitvice have developed their latest product, SatStacker, to help you accumulate Bitcoin over the long term. SatStacker allows you to set up a recurring purchase order directly from your bank account. It then accumulates Bitcoin for you at the frequency and at the amount you choose, depositing that Bitcoin directly into your self-custody wallet. There are many uses for SatStacker, from simply automating a weekly purchase of some Bitcoin for your own personal stack to setting up a long-term investment fund for your kids. Accumulating Bitcoin in automated regular amounts has never been simpler, safer, and more convenient. Try out SatStacker today, and there will be a link in the description of both the audio version and the YouTube podcast. Also, one more admin thing before we get into the news. Just a reminder that this week the IRR is coming to KZN. We will be near Howick on the 16th of November at 6 o'clock in the tap room at the Midlands Fable at 85 Curry's Post Road. And on the 17th of November at 6 o'clock, we will be at the corner of Aurora and Centenary Boulevard in Mhlanga in meeting room Mfolozi 1 and 2. So thanks very much, everyone. Right. So just a very brief story before we get into things. And that is a follow-up from last week with the donkey cart story. Now, we talked at length, I think it was Herman and Chris and I talked a little bit about how what we thought about this issue of the Northwest government supplying some of its people with donkey carts. However, it turns out that said supplied donkey carts don't seem to work properly. Not only are they very expensive and overinflated in price, but they apparently broke down after the first usage. According to a local guy, one of the recipients of the donkey carts, the cart tongue should have been made of stronger steel, not this weak steel, which is already bending due to being unable to deal with the weight of the passengers. One of the recipients' families have decided to park their cart for now, as they are aware that the other ones have already broken down. This user said, "We've heard that others have broken down, even this one, although we're yet to use it. You can see that it can easily break down." So not great performance there from the Northwest government. Okay. That aside.
Are these Hong Kong carts?
Clearly. Clearly they are. Let us start our first story for today. And this is Cyril Ramaphosa's letter to the nation. So he writes one every Monday. They're usually not that interesting, but this one, I think, in light of some of the recent debates we've been having on the show, is quite interesting indeed. The headline is BBBEE is here to stay. Ramaphosa says, "As a society, we have understood that economic transformation could not simply be left to markets, but we would need special interventions to make it happen. This is why the Bill of Rights in our Constitution says that to promote the achievement of equality, legislative and other measures may need to be taken to advance people who had been disadvantaged by unfair discrimination. The same Constitution provides for both value for money and empowerment in public procurement. It says that when the public bodies contract for goods and services, they must do so in a manner that is fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective. It also says the state must implement a preferential procurement policy that advances people who have been disadvantaged by unfair discrimination. In South Africa, this refers to black people, women, and people with disabilities. It is in this context that the preferential procurement regulations published by the National Treasury last week need to be understood. Government remains wholly committed to transformation and empowerment as envisioned by the Constitution. Some people, for their own reasons, have mischaracterized the purpose and effect of these new regulations. Some commentaries even claim that this is government backtracking on its commitment to broad-based black economic empowerment. This claim is far from the truth. Terence, what do you make of these comments by the president, very much in defense of BEE, and is he correct to say that the recent regulations don't backtrack whatsoever on BEE?
Well, I was kind of expecting something like this. You know, I said a week or two ago that, you know, that maybe there's some green shoots as grounds for optimism, and I stand by that. But I also made it very, very clear that this isn't kind of a one way street. You've got let's say the Overton window is open, but you still have to go through it. And there are many interests, some pecuniary, some ideological, that will push back hard. And I think that what you're seeing there from President Ramaphosa is entirely correct. Now, I think what the regulations do, they do take away some of the more damaging let's say insane ideas about you know, disqualifying potential bidders off the bat because they're not sufficiently the ownership structure is not to the liking of the state. But they don't rule out the idea that you could apply preferences. But they don't specify necessarily those preferences have to be racial. It talks about, I think, specific goals is the term they use. So, you can skin a cat many, many different ways. I think what South Africa has, and I think this is something that that four years of the now not so new dawn have demonstrated, is that the president is not, never really has been, a reformer. He was Zuma's number two. He chaired cadre deployment that gave us these wonderful these wonderful positions. He went to the Zondo Commission and said, "Oh, please, Daddy, don't tell us that we've been so naughty." There's not a lot of reformist impulse I can see, and I think that in the pushback about getting to sort of a sensible business environment in which real entrepreneurs, you know, actually have the have the space to thrive. Because remember, what a policy like BEE does is it gives certain designated beneficiaries a leg up, and, you know, well, you know, more strength to them, I suppose. But it does raise cost structures. It distorts markets, and it's not something that that most particularly small scale operators are ever going to get a look at onto. So, yeah, you know, and as I say, any move to try and correct this will encounter pushback. And I imagine that that President Ramaphosa will be an intimate part of that pushback.
Very much so. I think it's still quite interesting, though, that this even quite mild pullback on BEE, I don't know. It depends how you interpret it. Maybe not that mild, but some of the pullbacks from BEE have generated quite a lot of rhetorical pullback, rhetorical reversing of direction, but the policies still remain. And in this case, the reduction of BEE, which originally, I mean, the regulations that had to be replaced here were regulations that said that if a company didn't meet the BEE standards, you couldn't even consider them, even if there were literally no other people that were asking for the tender. Michael, what do you make of this? What do you make of the president's thoughts here on BEE, and where do you think the debate is standing now?
I agree fully with Terence's characterization of it. I think, I mean, what is interesting to me, what it reminds me of actually is very much the 1980s, and a key number of nationalists who were very prominent and who were anxious to be seen to be doing better things and appearing more human in the eyes of the world, and so on. And that, there's this whole idea that, you know, we aren't bad people. We're trying our best. And you had people like Pete Kernhoff, and Chris here. Pete Kernhoff, I'm thinking particularly of sporting policy, and there were all those enormously convoluted differentials between international events and teams, international teams playing, and you were allowed to have, you know, people from different races attending those in the same venue, and that was distinct from, you know, the local events with the same performers or the same teams were playing, but it wasn't an international event. So you go from Pete Kernhoff, some of his famous phrases, "There's a beautiful thing happening in Soweto," was one of them, and of course his statement in New York that apartheid are dead, and so on. And then you go on to Chris Hearn. So now we're into the sort of final stage. The Irvington window is really open for the Nats. It's reform all the way. We are not the nasty people that everybody thought we were being, and apartheid is really about finding solutions. And, you know, and he came up with all those enormously complex constitutional arrangements. And the whole thing was really trying to introduce a little bit of change for their benefit, but not at the risk of actually getting rid of apartheid and losing the support of your voters. And I think that's, you know, Terence referring to the open window being open, but now you have to go through it. You got that sense in the 1980s that the Nats kind of knew where history was leading them. It was becoming unavoidable, but they were still digging in their heels. We had those dreadful states of emergencies, the killings and all kinds of awful things still to go. Before, you know, the truth eventually dawned. And I think that is the problem. And I want to just mention here, I'm talking about the 1980s, but in a very fine piece this morning on Daily Friend, Terence writes about the South African Communist Party and its Red October campaign. And this, of course, harks back to Russia in 1917. And go and have a look at Terence's piece. It's called "When It's Russia in 1917. And it's a good, thorough look at the kind of rhetoric that we hear from so many of our political leaders about what needs to be done, what's wrong, and where we want to go, and just how pitifully misguided and out of touch it is with the reality that we are living in South Africa, unemployment, growth rate, what people really want and need, and how to get it. And so to come all the way back to Ramaphosa and BBBEE, you know, here again, it's plain to most sensible people that this kind of model of empowerment is simply not working. It's not helping. This massive unemployment rate, millions of people immiserated, very little hope of getting just a foothold in the economy, or having rights to property and assets and so on. And here they are talking about something which we now know is benefiting only a small elite politically connected group. Yeah.
So yeah, and I like those 80s comparisons. I wasn't around then, so I can't contribute them, but I think it does suggest that we're sort of at the turn of an ideological era, when the fact that the defensives of BEE remain, but they're far more timid, I feel, than they used to be in some ways.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, you know, you never, as far as I can judge, you never see anybody trying to defend BEE on its record. It's always done on its intentions. And this is if you look at the president's letter today, well, this was one of the greatest transformative pieces of legislation, blah 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 blah, and yeah, you know, okay, great. What is it? Well, you know, there's no sort of handy set of statistics about what it's produced. Mm. By the way, yes, the 1980s, remember, we also had the Karate Kid, now we've got Cobra Kai, so something is coming.
Yeah. Exactly on that point, because it's sort of the government has this problem where it hails BEE as one of its most important policy changes. It hails BEE as this great epoch-defining piece of legislation that is really bringing transformation to South African society. And at the same time, it says nothing has changed, which is why we need more BEE. Well, which one is it? is this a great piece of policy that needs to be that we need to be celebrating because of all it's done, or has it completely failed, which is why for some reason we need to do more of what we've already been doing? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And that is exactly why they can't defend it, because their own rhetoric about the country claims that they've failed to transform it. It's really weird.
You know, this is something, the poverty alleviating initiatives that the government has undertaken, things like the provision of social grants, housing, whatever, those are all actually done on a socioeconomic, not a racial basis. You know, there are a small number of white people who get social grants. In fact, I've met a couple of them. There are a small number of white people who benefit from some RDP housing or social housing.
I've actually met some of them. I was in the Eastern Cape a couple of years ago, and I was in a small rural village in Transkei, and you know, sort of old Afrikaans guy comes up to me. He's like, "Oh yeah, no, I stay there. I got an RDP house here." It was very strange.
Yeah, so you know, look, the thing is that their own record actually speaks against their rhetoric. Now I know that some of our colleagues would be very, very upset with me for, you know, speaking well of the social grant system. But I think, you know, for the half the population that lives below the poverty line, that's a godsend. Mm.
Yeah. But anyway, something to keep watching. And, you know, hopefully there'll be more speeches about how BEE is not going away, and at the same time, more rollbacks of BEE in our legislation. That would be, I think, something I could definitely
live with. We could live with the rhetoric.
Yes, we can live with the rhetoric. Okay. So there's been some concern once again about the South African Post Office. The Chair of Parliament's Communications and Digital Technologies Portfolio Committee has urged the government to allocate funds to the Post Office, saying failure to do so could be, quote, catastrophic to service delivery. That there's some concern that there wasn't enough money granted to the Post Office in the medium-term budget policy statement, which came out last month. Apparently, the Post Office is basically insolvent. And it's also being split from Postbank in order for Postbank to meet some banking requirements. As a result, the Post Office is in danger of completely going under and not being able to pay any of its staff, according to some of the reporting. Pretty devastating stuff for anyone, I think, who works at the Post Office. But Terence, you know, we have this issue of the Post Office where I think the only people who use it now are those who really have no other choice. I think the middle classes have, by and large, mostly managed to escape the Post Office. What do we do with the Post Office? Can it make money? Can it be better managed? Should it be privatized? What are your thoughts on this?
Okay. There is another group that has no choice to move away from the Post Office. That is people who basically participate in e-commerce, because everyone else around the world uses post offices. You know, whether you're in Vietnam or Vanuatu or Vancouver, you know, you take it to the post office and you post it. Now, I remember I bought something from this guy in America, and I said, look, you know, you got to register it and whatever. And he said, no, he doesn't think that's going to be necessary. I mean, you send stuff to Italy. And I said, well, if you can arrange with the Rome post office to deliver it in Joburg, I'm happy to do that. But, you know, we're dealing with the South African post office. I actually like to keep an eye on these things. And usually, like in a docks in South Africa, at least 40 days, you know, what the time Jesus spent out in the wilderness. That's kind of what, you know, where I wait for it to just get into customs. And then, you know, it's another couple of weeks. Okay, there is a kernel of truth to what they say. The post office, the whole business model depends on subsidizing. I've spoken to logistics people there. So you take any major city in South Africa, they can deliver cheaper, faster, you know, by any metric, just better than the post office can. So where they can't is out in the sticks. It's the margins there are just make it. Michael seems to have
lost Michael.
Interneted off. Okay.
Oh, well, we'll keep going.
Okay. So yeah, this is the problem. Private courier companies or whatever can't service those outlying areas. And, you know, that was, I think, one of the reasons why they tried to get the social grants, you know, to provide another revenue stream. And also because the post office infrastructure is widespread. they've also been major, but the thing is that it has to an extent been underfunded, but also incredibly badly managed. And I think, particularly that sort of period between, between the rise of email, which killed a lot of the snail mail operation, and then also the rise of courier companies, because things were just taking too long. And at that stage, I remember around 2010, there were these series of strikes, and they would go for like 3 months. And I remember at that stage, Amazon was still actually shipping through the post office. And, you would order something and, 3-4 months later, it may or may not come. So, yeah, it has a massive credibility problem. This becomes a kind of chicken and egg thing. Okay, you're going to commit money to this thing, but people don't trust it, so they won't use it. So, oh, you're throwing good money after bad. My sense of it is if Mark Barnes, who was the CEO, wants to buy it, I'd say, by all means. Post office is kind of one of those pieces of infrastructure you actually find it very, very difficult to get away from, because everyone has one. There's an international postal union, and I don't think that. I don't think that a private enterprise could at this point take up all of those responsibilities. But a privatized post office, I think, is something that we should very seriously consider.
Michael, are you back with us?
I am indeed. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Yes, we can. What are your thoughts on the post office in general? I mean, have you utilized its services in the recent past?
I haven't. I mean, I was thinking as Terence was speaking there, having come from a media background, I'm very conscious of how technological change has impacted so many things that we do. I look around at my office here behind me, the racks of CDs, which, when I was in my 40s, I thought it took a while to progress from records to CDs. And CDs are now, old-fashioned, and people laugh at me when I haul out a CD. And I think the post office, like the media, like so many of the other things, it was for 100 years or 200 years, 300 years, it was central to our kind of social mobility and our interconnectedness and our sense of being in the world. Our intimacy even was so directly connected with the idea of being able to write thoughts down and send them off to another part of the world. Even the literature, it's affected our literature and so on. Stamp collectors, I love the idea of stamp collectors who become passionate about these quite arcane things. And it's quite odd to think that's simply no more in a way. So I do, on the one hand, it does seem to be quite an anachronistic thing, a post office. I actually almost never get anything in the post. My wife still does. And whenever I think of the post box, it seems quite an odd thing to me. And yet, you keep being asked to provide proof of your home address, and invariably, and people say, well, something you've had in the post. Well, fewer and fewer people are getting things in the post. But having said all that, I think the post office does play a role, and maybe the problem really seems to have been that it was, this vast organization at some point. It needed to be, but it simply wasn't able to adapt quickly enough to the fact that its scale was reducing, its function was changing. And that seems the tragic case in South Africa, but so much else is so slow to adapt, certainly in the purview of the state. But we were speaking just briefly before coming on air, I'm one of those who's not necessarily always inclined to make as my first choice a privatizing process where something has been done in the past by the state. I think there can be places where there's no reason in my mind why the state shouldn't be able to do something efficiently if it's well managed. Eskom was a very good example through all the very, very poorly managed decades of National Party rule. there were some things that the state managed to do pretty well. I think that was probably one of them, and there might have been other things, the weather service maybe, or whatever. I'm sure there were all kinds. And it's simply because there were rules, people stuck to them. The function was very clearly defined, sense of responsibility, accountability, and so on. And it, you know, so it can work. So I don't necessarily think that privatizing this would be the answer. I don't know how you'd make a profit out of the postal service, but there does seem to be a role still for some kind of national organization that keeps people in touch with one another.
I think in the short term, we probably privatization. I mean, we're probably not going to get a lot of political change until the government changes. But
no.
The state of the post office is such that either replacing the management or privatizing it would probably be a good first start, and then we sort of see where we can go from there. But anyway, let's move on to our last story of today. And this is another thing that came out from the ANC's National Executive Committee meeting. I think the BEE comments from Robert Voice were probably due to some pressure at that meeting. But another thing was that the ANC's leadership says that they want to raise the COVID-19 social relief of distress grant in line with inflation, or to 480 rand a month, which will make it the same as the child support grant, as part of a number of things that they believe will cushion poor people from the soaring cost of living. It's kind of a bit strange because it's still called the COVID Social Relief and Distress Grant, rather than what is clearly slowly turning into, which is a universal basic income kind of situation. But the ANC said that this is definitely in their policy objectives. They want to raise it. They want to expand it to more people. But it still needs to get through Treasury, which, apart from reducing some of the BEE regulations, has now also said that that there needs to be a serious increase in revenue collection before the grants could be extended and upgraded in terms of how much they pay out. Michael, what do you think of the social relief grant? It's a bit odd because it's sort of like this thing we got as an emergency measure. And as they say, as that old American joke goes, there's nothing so temporary as a temporary so permanent as a temporary government program. What do you make of this?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably right. And, you know, if one thinks of what the ANC can offer the country in a sense, the electorate, it's steadily dwindling number of supporters. The obvious things would be things like BEE and grants and you know, goodies that they can give away. So it's,
well, and
you know,
donkey carts, but apparently that didn't work out.
Yes, yes.
Nicholas,
well, you know, oh dear. So it is. I mean, it is worrying. You think what that money could be spent on? Or just, you know, perhaps paying off some of the debt might be probably the best thing to do.
Cushioning poverty is not a long-term solution.
No.
You know, I think for temporary emergency times, it definitely makes some sense. But if it's now going up to, say, the child grants thing and it's essentially becoming permanent, well, then it's a permanent thing on the tax. And that means that it's got a whole host of things down the line. Even if it was a good idea originally, I think that it's becoming less sustainable. I don't know. Terrence, what do you think of this?
Look, you know, I think that if you look at this sort of thing in longer-term perspective, with the way the structure of production and commerce is changing, we are going to have to at some point reckon with a phenomenon of, you know, I think quite significant structural unemployment. You know, there's in some futuristic fiction, this is factored in that, you know, 20% of the population doesn't work anymore. And I think South Africa is, in a sense, in that sort of situation because, you know, jobs that are on offer require skills that people don't have or whatever. And, you know, I think that there, you know, aside from any moral or ethical considerations, there's also an enormous, like, loss of human potential. So, you know, I would like to actually expand that even higher, but that isn't an ideal world. Okay, that's a sort of, as I say, an ethical position, and I'm sure that there are arguments against it. But, you know, it all comes down to the basic question: where's the money going to come from? Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that, you know, if this is the way you want to go into this kind of universal payment, okay, we can look at that. But then you have to encourage the creation of wealth.
Mm.
And you know, I say, okay, the first thing that has to go is BE completely. You say, well, anybody who can, you know, who can make a buck that we can tax, go ahead and do it, and we are going to make that environment as conducive to do so as possible. You know, and then we say, well, you right. know, hopefully that'll then raise the revenue that you can actually use to support the population that is structurally excluded.
Right. When the ANC isn't play acting at being great communist revolutionaries, it sometimes likes to pretend that it's a social democratic party. And on those days, they should take note of the model that a lot of Scandinavian countries have done, which is fairly free markets with a generous welfare system. And they're kind of trying to have the worst of both worlds, which is a very restrictive market, but also a generous welfare system that can't be afforded. It's a short.
Yeah, well, look, that on that. That's a. I think it was the Danish Prime Minister was in America about 10 years ago, and he was speaking at Harvard, and he was taking questions from, you know, the cream of America's intellectual crop. He said, "I'm just going to stop everyone here. Denmark is not a socialist country. We are a market economy." Now let's carry on. You know, you know, and there's something that I've noticed. People on both the left and the right speaking about those Nordic countries is that they try to shoehorn them into some sort of, you know, dystopian communist horror show, or you know, and you know,
the perfect society. Yeah,
yeah. You know, they're countries with a particular mix that seems to work fine for them. But if, you know, if that is your model, then actually try and learn from it. Create your wealth and then redistribute it.
Mm-hmm. Can't have no wealth creation and redistribution. Yeah. But anyway,
Lars.
I think we shall close there for today. So thank you very much, everyone. Sorry for the slight technical problems. If you're in case, then look out for us this week, and we'll see you tomorrow on the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.